This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Some people are calling it the Harry Potter effect. It goes like this. More than a decade ago, groups of American children began falling in love with books about a boy wizard, his friends, and a magical place called Hogwarts. These American kids couldn't get through the stories fast enough, often reading the complex tales over and over again while eagerly anticipating the next installment. Now, many of these avid child readers are college age, and scholars across the nation say the impact on university classrooms is remarkable. Two such scholars are with us this hour to stress how a renewed love of reading could be changing education, but also to dig deeper into something we might just call the Hermione impact. One hint, it's great news for those who think learning is cool. For the rest of the story, stay tuned. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Harry Potter. You've heard of him, but what do you think his effect might now be on American education? If you have an opinion on that, a tale to tell about how the Harry Potter books have or have not had an impact on you, your children, or anyone else you know, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. With me, two scholars who say they and many other educators have only recently begun to notice an impact in college classrooms connected to young adults who first began reading the Potter tales many years ago. But before I even introduce our guests, here's a brief reminder of what we'll be encountering this hour.
Hagrid stared wildly at Harry. "But you must know about your mum and dad," he said. "I mean, they're famous. You're famous."
"What? My mum and dad weren't famous, were they?"
"You don't know. You don't know. Oh!"
Hagrid ran his fingers through his hair, fixing Harry with a bewildered stare. "You don't know what you are," he said finally. Uncle Vernon suddenly found his voice. "Stop," he commanded. "Stop right there, sir. I forbid you to tell the boy anything." A braver man than Vernon Dursley would have quailed under the furious look Hagrid now gave him. When Hagrid spoke, his every syllable trembled with rage.
"You never told him. Never told him what was in the letter Dumbledore left for him. I was there. I saw Dumbledore leave it, Dursley, and you've kept it from him all these years."
"Kept what from me?" said Harry eagerly.
"Stop! I forbid you!"
yelled Uncle Vernon in panic. Aunt Petunia gave a gasp of horror.
"Ah, go boil your heads, both of you," said Hagrid. "Harry, you're a wizard."
From the Random House audiobooks edition of the first book in the series, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, featuring readings by the phenomenal voice actor Jim Dale. He does all the voices in all the books as he reads every word as it was originally written. Suzanne Keene, specialist in British literature and professor of English, you are among those saying you're thrilled with what you've been noticing in classrooms lately. Tell us about that, and what comes to mind for you when you hear that early chapter in the first Harry Potter book read aloud?
Well, it's such an iconic scene when Hagrid arrives, having really pursued the Dursley family to this shack in the middle of a little island out in the surrounded by waves, and announces that Harry is a wizard to a child who has been abused and neglected and has always felt different from people around him. So it's a moment that many readers of children's books can identify with, because it's a fantasy that I think we all have, learning that there was something special about our parentage or that we had unique gifts that others around us did not recognize. And ironically, millions and millions of children read that scene or had it read to them or heard it on one of these tapes and became part of a generation that shared that experience. So a scene that really is about discovering uniqueness, even bizarre uniqueness. You're a wizard. Haven't you ever made anything happen without intending it? Hagrid later asks. Haven't, you know, when you've had gotten a strong emotional feeling, has something happened that has been so startling or surprising? So this uniqueness that is announced created a situation over the, not just the years and the English language readership, but in translation around the world, where children of a certain age, of a certain generation, really became a generation, the generation of Harry Potter readers. And in the college classroom, the Harry Potter readers are now sophomores, juniors, depending on when they started. But it was a really noticeable shift in the attitude towards reading, particularly reading long, complex novels. And I noticed it particularly in my teaching of Charles Dickens, books that students, college-age students, very gifted students, would have struggled to follow and to enjoy even 5 years ago. They now grasp, enjoy, they catch the satire, they enjoy the humor, they follow the multi-plot novels, they see the symbolism in a way that Harry Potter has really trained them to do. And they've been trained in such a way, not in the classroom, but through their pleasure reading and through their sense of a shared love that they have with other kids their own age who also grew up reading Harry Potter, has really changed the way students think about what you might do with a book, that you might embrace a long book for pleasure and discover these possibilities for relationship with others through the reading experience.
And I understand, Suzanne Keene, that there actually have been some studies, some national surveys by the National Education Association in conjunction with the Census Bureau that show some remarkable transformations over a bit more than the past decade with attitudes towards reading and how much people of different age groups actually are reading. So we'll get into all of that in a moment. But there's another aspect here that I'm sure our other guest wants to get to, also with us, a researcher of Harry Potter literature, as well as a professor of writing and rhetoric, Elizabeth Gumnoir. Dr. Gumnoir, you're in agreement with those who say that a love of reading, even a passion for complicated literature, is now showing up among college students.
Yeah.
But you go even further, saying there may well be an additional impact on young people that could be a big plus throughout American education. And much of this is connected to what I guess we would call the female heroine in the Harry Potter stories. Mm-hmm. Her name, of course, Hermione Granger. And going back now to this Random House audio, here's a critical moment in Volume 1, The Sorcerer's Stone.
Hermione had managed to get to her feet at last. "I went looking for the troll because I thought I could deal with it on my own, you know, because I've read all about them." Ron dropped his wand. Hermione Granger telling a downright lie to a teacher? "If they hadn't found me, I'd be dead now. Harry stuck his wand up its nose and Ron knocked it out with his own club. They didn't have time to come and fetch anyone. It was about to finish me off when they arrived." Harry and Ron tried to look as though this story wasn't new to them. "Well, in that case," said Professor McGonagall, staring at the three of them, "Miss Granger, you foolish girl, how could you think of tackling a mountain troll on your own?" Hermione hung her head. Harry was speechless. Hermione was the last person to do anything against the rules, and here she was, pretending she had to get them out of trouble. It was as if Snape had started handing out sweets. "Miss Granger, 5 points will be taken from Gryffindor for this," said Professor McGonagall. "I'm very disappointed in you. If you're not hurt at all, you'd better get off to Gryffindor Tower. Students are finishing the feast in their houses." Hermione left. Professor McGonagall turned to Harry and Ron. "Well, I still say you were lucky, but not many first years could have taken on a full-grown mountain troll. You each win Gryffindor 5 points. Professor Dumbledore will be informed of this. You may go." They hurried out of the chamber and didn't speak at all until they had climbed 2 floors up. It was a relief to be away from the smell of the troll, quite apart from anything else. "We should have gotten more than 10 points, Ron grumbled. 5, you mean, once she's taken off Hermione's. Good of her to get us out of trouble like that, Ron admitted. Mind you, we did save her." "She might not have needed saving if we hadn't locked the thing in with her," Harry reminded him. They had reached the portrait of the fat lady. "Pigsnout," they said, and entered. The common room was packed and noisy. Everyone was eating the food that had been sent up. Hermione, however, stood alone by the door, waiting for them. There was a very embarrassed pause. Then, none of them looking at each other, they all said, "Thanks," and hurried off to get plates. But from that moment on, Hermione Granger became their friend. There are some things
You can't share without ending up liking each other. And knocking out a 12-foot mountain troll is one of them.
So, Elizabeth Gumnior, fill in the gaps for us, if you would, about this completely fictional character, Hermione, and how you think she's having such a positive effect on attitudes towards education.
Hermione is the ultimate bookworm. She is the one who, even before she gets to Hogwarts, reads all about Hogwarts. And she is the studious one. In the beginning, if you remember, anybody who's read the books or watched the movies knows that Ron and Harry are actually sort of reacting in a very typical way. They're sniggering. They're laughing at her. She is the bookworm, the outsider. Nobody wants to be friends with her because of that. And then she becomes, through particularly the troll adventure, it becomes clear that she is more than that. That she is also very courageous and loyal, that she is willing to give a little bit of herself in return to have a friendship established with the two boys. In the later books, she becomes, I think, the real sort of intellectual force behind that trio. She is the one who has read a lot and knows history from those readings. She knows a lot about the wizarding world, that some of it is arcane knowledge that one could only have through research and reading. And in many situations, that knowledge becomes very useful. It becomes the factor that really saves them out, helps them out in a lot of tricky situations, and ultimately really her attitude towards research, towards learning, makes the resolution of the story possible.
So over and over and over again.
Yes.
It's the fact that, yes, Hermione Granger was a bookworm.
Yes.
Was so smart, was so much involved in intellectual pursuits.
Mm-hmm.
That actually saves the lives of,
yes,
the trio,
yes,
of Ron and Harry and, yes, Hermione.
Yeah.
And you think as a result of that, kids who fell in love with these stories began to see learning in a different way?
Yes, yes. I think brainy is the new cool. We see that not only through Harry Potter, but also the new Sherlock series by the BBC. That brainy, that smart, that intelligent, anxious to learn, means something more than just, oh, dork, nerd. Nerd is actually cool. Geek is cool. And there's a pride among smart kids that makes this now the real revenge of the nerds.
I think one of the really funny questions about Hermione is why she's not a Ravenclaw.
Yes.
You know,
yes,
when the Sorting Hat, yes, chooses, yes, which of the, yes, four houses, yeah, you're supposed to be in, you'd think a kid like Hermione, who's so bookish and whose first impulse is always to go to the library, that surely this would be, because Ravenclaw really is the nerdy,
wit,
yeah,
beyond
philosophical,
measure is man's greatest,
exactly,
treasure.
These, yeah, are the smart kids.
Yes.
In
I,
of course, when I took the Sorting Hat test, I am a Ravenclaw.
I am too.
Naturally, since we're in the professoriate, that is
And I
well
was
known.
Actually, I was actually quite intrigued by that. That there's a place, and I think that's what other kids are feeling too. That there's a place for smart kids now, and it's not the AV room, the audiovisual,
right,
geek. You know, it's somewhere else too.
That's right. And then the cool thing is that there's Hermione, who could be a Ravenclaw because she's got the smarts for it. She's got,
yes,
the wit beyond measure.
Yes. Yes.
But instead, she uses that braininess in action in the world. I mean, she's,
yes,
just taken out a,
yes, yes,
mountain troll. She's,
right, right.
She's,
and
a,
to show the kind of courage that goes,
she's got the courage
Gryffindor.
Of a Gryffindor.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
So to you,
yes,
who are listening, got a favorite theme from one of the Harry Potter books? A story about how these books affected you, your children, someone else you know? Elizabeth Gumnior from James Madison University, Suzanne Keene from Washington and Lee University, are here to tell us more about their view, but we'd love to hear yours too when we get back in a bit more than 1 minute.
"What's going on here?" came the cold, drawling voice of Draco Malfoy. Harry started stuffing everything feverishly into his ripped bag, desperate to get away before Malfoy could hear his musical valentine. "What's all this commotion?" said another familiar voice as Percy Weasley arrived. Losing his head, Harry tried to make a run for it, but the dwarf seized him around the knees and brought him crashing to the floor. "Right," he said, sitting on Harry's ankles. "Here's your singing valentine. His eyes are as green as a fresh-pickled toad. His hair is as dark as a blackboard. I wish he were mine. He's really divine. The hero who conquered the Dark Lord." Harry would have given all the golden Gringotts to evaporate on the spot.
That's the amazing voice of Jim Dale from the Random House audiobooks version of Volume 2, Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Chair of the Washington and Lee University English Department, Suzanne Keene, is one of our guests. Sitting next to her, James Madison University Professor of Writing, Rhetoric, and Technical Communication, Elizabeth Gumnior. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And Suzanne, being read to at a very young age, as so many children were at the age of 4, 5, 6, even 7, as well as reading yourself something that you so fell in love with, I guess your point is you can't overstate how important that becomes?
It's incredibly important for parents or other caregivers to read to children. It makes their move into literacy substantially easier. But once you're a literate reader, say you're age 10 and you can really read, that's most people consider that to be the threshold, there's a question as to how you're going to continue that behavior into the teenage years. And in the past, in fact, as recently as 2002, the young adult age group of 18 to 24-year-olds was showing precipitous declines in the amount of literary reading that they were doing in a given year, surveyed by the U.S. Census in large samples of over 18,000 adult Americans, the young people showed a 20% rate of decline in the amount of literary reading that they were doing. Now, more recently, in 2009, in a report done by the NEA called Reading on the Rise, that pattern has been reversed, so that now there's an increase in reading among Americans for the first time in 25 years. And in particular, the 18 to 24-year-olds showed the most rapid rate of increase, 21%, and most of the new readers, there were 16.6 million new adult readers of literature in 2008, and 3.4 million of those additional readers were young adults. Most of the new readers were reading fiction. So this tells us that there's something going on in the culture that was enough of a phenomenon that just the aging of the Generation Hex readers, the kids who grew up reading Harry Potter.
Okay, say that again.
The Generation Hex readers, that's a way of characterizing.
Yeah, but you got to say it so it's
Generation Hex.
Hex. Yes.
The Generation Hex readers these are the kids who were growing up with Harry Potter, reading the books between 1997 and 2007, really living, some of them were 11 when Harry Potter was 11 and so forth. But these children grew up to be the college students that we've been speaking about. And they are a significant enough part of this U.S. Census mm-hmm. sample that we are actually seeing a reversal of a historic decline in reading, and we are now seeing the opposite, an increase. So now mm-hmm. a little over half adult Americans in the United States claim to be literary readers.
888-WMRA Talk, our phone number. We already have several posts on Facebook. I'll try to get to those soon. But we now have Carolyn on the line calling us from Charlottesville. Carolyn, thanks for doing that. Your question or comment for Suzanne Keene and or Elizabeth Gumnior, please.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Tom. I love your show, and I agree 100% with your guests. My son is now 19, and he has been reading Harry Potter since, you know, we read it to him, and then he's read it, and he was just talking yesterday about enjoying War and Peace, so I know exactly yes. the effect that they're talking about, of being able to understand complex novels. My comment, though, was a situation I had when he was in second or third grade. I was a volunteer coordinator of a little chess club at his elementary school, and we wanted to do a game of wizard chess, if you remember from the first Harry Potter book. And there was one particular mom who objected. Harry Potter was about wizards, and wizards were evil, and if you remember all those controversies back when it first came out of is this an evil book and all that sort of stuff. And the kids, so they got firsthand experience with what censorship, a little bit of what censorship. That in and of itself, I thought, was a really wonderful experience. They got an eye-opening view of the world. And, you know, do you read this? Do you not read it? Do you let... You know, do you listen to, who do you listen to, and you know, all those issues, and I just thought I wanted to share that with you.
Yeah. I think this is one of the effects that the whole Harry Potter phenomenon has had, that these kids grew up a lot more conscious in many ways about the controversy or controversies surrounding the Harry Potter books. And that has had an effect on them, a very positive effect, an awareness of how their private reading is also a public issue. And that awareness carries over into a more world awareness among our college students right now. I see that as part and parcel, these experiences are part and parcel of the Harry Potter phenomenon and the impact that it has on college students. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I do. And I think you even see a sort of secondary phenomenon of children who grew up in communities where there was a religious conviction that caused the adults to prohibit students or their children from reading Harry Potter, that when they reach college age and they achieve the freedom of being in the dormitory, no longer in the family home, one of the things that they do is they pick up and read Harry Potter.
Yes.
So these are the older readers now in their late teens and 20s, realizing, catching up really with what their generation has been taking in.
Yeah.
And it's clear that, you know, some of them love it, some of them don't. They're not all people are fantasy fiction fans, but it certainly is enough of a shared experience of the generation that the kids who were deprived of it by parents or pastors in largely Protestant evangelical denominations, that's where most of the critique of Harry Potter came from, are catching up with it once they come to college. The other thing I would say is that criticism, which all of us who have read Harry Potter or taught Harry Potter have encountered, begins to look a little bit silly when you realize that the texts are very clearly Christian allegories.
Yes. Yes.
And that there are some, I mean, there's some direct...
Defend that. Explain that.
Okay.
How are they Christian allegory?
Well, for instance, in the middle of book seven, which is the climactic book of the series, on Christmas Eve, Harry and Hermione go to a graveyard to seek out, it's in Godric's Hollow, and they go to seek out the graves of both of Harry's parents and of other people who are buried in this small village graveyard. Inside the church, parishioners are singing Christmas carols. And engraved on the stones are quotations that if you look them up in the King James Bible, you discover they come from the Sermon on the Mount. So that's embedded right in the middle of Harry Potter Book 7, a sort of Christian statement. And that's fairly subtle because you'd have to know how to do a little research and chase down that clue. But not so subtle is the fact that throughout the stories, particularly in Book 7, there's an emphasis on sacrificial giving, on love that protects those who have been exposed to it, love and friendship as a way of protecting people from evil, and also in resurrection. I mean, there's a straight-up resurrection story at the end of... So these are pretty obvious, kind of hit you on the head with a hammer aspects of Christian symbolism, and there's lots more for those who are interested in it. There's a fabulous set of books by a man named John Granger who describes...
I was just going to mention
John. Well, maybe you should say a little bit about John Granger's
before
work.
Before you do, I want to thank Carolyn for her call. Let anybody else know who's just joined us that we're talking about the Harry Potter effect on college classrooms and, in fact, educational institutions across the country, maybe across the world at this point. Phone number, if you want to join the conversation, 888-WMRA, talk 888-967-2825. Elizabeth Gumnior from James Madison University and Suzanne Keene from Washington and Lee University are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And we've got several comments on Facebook. So this one from Debbie, I think, is real close to what Carolyn was just saying. But let me ask for your response, if I could, Elizabeth. She says, what a great theme to explore. And I'm glad to hear the effect that is being seen now. I think one of the most important themes of the whole series was about choices. It is our choices that determine who we are, not some predetermined fate or set of attributes, and that certainly was apparent in the second book, The Chamber of Secrets, according to Debbie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have any thoughts?
Yeah, that's one of the major themes that we see pop up throughout the entire series. It's all about choices. It's about moral choices, ethical choices, choices between self-preservation and the preservation of an entire community. And that is what Dumbledore, Hogwarts headmaster and mentor to Harry, and really the entire trio, always emphasizes. It is our choices, Harry, that define us, that determine who we are and how we will be seen, not some sort of prejudicial belief in a fate or something like that. And choices, this is now what we are seeing our students really enact. In the last decade, particularly in the last 5 years, I have seen really our students become more politically aware, more involved, more engaged. The kind of messages that we try, for instance, with our JMU motto to sort of reinforce or our mission statement, we are hopefully educating engaged citizens. We see them already bring a sense of citizenship to the college experience. This is now our mission seems like something that rolls very easily into their lives, whereas a decade ago that was not necessarily the case. That talk about citizenship, for instance, was much more difficult to do. Talk about political issues, particularly post 9/11, was very, very difficult. But it has gradually gotten easier, in part because politics is also all about choices. And that message is already deeply conscious to our students.
Phone number 888-WMRA Talk. Next, we have Terry. Terry, where are you calling us from?
I'm in Charlottesville.
Thank you for joining the conversation. Your question or comment for Elizabeth Gumnior and or Susan Keene, please.
My comment is that I would like to have them think about the comparison between the series, the Oz books, and the Harry Potter books. I'm over 70, and I grew up reading the Oz books and latched on to Harry Potter the minute it came out. And admittedly, it's much more advanced literature. But the idea of the goals that you all have been talking about on the radio and the things that it teaches children, I think the series is very similar, and I'd like to hear comments by your speakers on that.
Well, I'll jump in and say that there are some really striking similarities. You have a fictional world, which is clearly an imaginary place. In the Oz books, it's a separate world to which the characters are transported. So it's a portal fantasy as opposed to a fantasy where the wizarding world is coexistent with the muggle world within something that's recognizably our world. But in terms of the ethical intentions and in the case of the Oz books, the political intentions, the use of a kind of political allegory that's there to be decoded if you choose to, but which doesn't detract from the pure fun and humor and enjoyment of reading the stories of what's happening to the characters as they move through the fictional world. there's a lot in common there. Now, people who are experts in children's literature would want to list a lot of other series that also seem to be present in some way or another in the Harry Potter phenomenon. Certainly the E. Nesbitt's books, I think. You probably also read those books alongside your Oz books, Five Children and It, and The Phoenix and the Carpet? Or I may have that title slightly wrong. But those books also resonate with Harry Potter readers. But there's a lot in common. And of course, it's been a longstanding goal of children writers for young readers to inculcate some ideas of civic virtue.
Yeah.
That's not a new thing.
Yes. No.
The fact that one could do it in a series of books that's about a bunch of kids who are going to basically a private school for wizarding and witchcraft is a little bit different. But
how do we know? I mean, whether it's Terry's point about the Oz books that I'm guessing that she might have been exposed to 50 or 60 years ago, if she's in her 70s now, or what the two of you are saying that you're seeing in your classrooms with children being much more interested in learning and especially much more enthusiastic about reading. How do you draw the connection either 60 years ago to the Oz books or today to the Harry Potter phenomenon?
Well, let's talk about the earlier caller who said that her kid, who is now 19, I think, is reading War and Peace. Mm-hmm. Now, anybody who's ever picked up War and Peace knows that is a doorstopper of a novel. I can attest from personal experience that it takes 300 pages before you get into the story of War and Peace. It's got a ton of complex plot lines going on. It's hard to follow. The names are confusing. And yet here's a 19-year-old from our own region who is apparently voluntarily reading War and Peace for pleasure. That's anecdotal.
Anecdotal. And admittedly, that caller Carolyn said that they started her son on the Harry Potter books at very early age. He loved them. But what I'm wondering is, do you actually hear from students saying,
oh, yes.
I learned to
time.
Love to read
yes.
because
all
of Harry
time.
Potter.
All the time. And then some of them make the leap, as that young person did, to what would be considered a classic book, Tolstoy. Others make the leap to adult fantasy fiction. So there's a lot of readers of George R.R. Martin right now who cut their teeth on Harry Potter and are now reading a grown-up fantasy series and watching the stuff on HBO. But whether they go in the direction of popular reading or they go in the more high literary direction of reading something like War and Peace or Dickens or Thackeray, they have capabilities as readers that have been exercised: forgetting yourself, surrendering for hours and hours into a fictional world, following complex plot lines, enjoying humor, being in the presence of people unlike oneself, and then enjoying that experience and coming out of that experience and being able to talk to other people in the real world who've shared that experience. I think that's really been a profoundly influencing, really generation-defining experience of this generation of young college students.
I would agree with that. And it's this idea of the shared text, the talk, the community that grows around the text, the sharing of
despite
ideas
being
and
so
impressions.
Much different in terms of the kind of media
The media are actually helping. The whole phenomenon of fan fiction or fan websites, a self-maintaining community of fans that speaks to each other, shares
with
each other.
They're not just going to movies.
They're reading
and also writing.
So
they're,
books, loving them. Education, thinking it's cool. Could the Harry Potter stories be enhancing both of these attitudes? Our guests say yes. What do you say? We've got a phone line just waiting for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Terry, again, thank you for your call. We'll be back in a bit more than 1 minute.
Give me Harry Potter, said Voldemort's voice, and none shall be harmed. Give me Harry Potter, and I shall leave the school untouched. Give me Harry Potter, and you will be rewarded. You have until midnight.
The silence swallowed them all again. Every head turned. Every eye in the place seemed to have found Harry, to hold him frozen in the glare of thousands of invisible beams. Then a figure rose from the Slytherin table, and he recognized Pansy Parkinson as she raised a shaking arm and screamed,
But he's there! Potter's there! Someone grab him!
Before Harry could speak, there was a massive movement. The Gryffindors in front of him had risen and stood facing, not Harry, but the Slytherins. Then the Hufflepuffs stood, and almost at the same moment, the Ravenclaws, all of them with their backs to Harry, all of them looking toward Pansy instead. And Harry, awestruck and overwhelmed, saw wands emerging everywhere, pulled from beneath cloaks and from under sleeves.
"Thank you, Miss Parkinson," said Professor McGonagall in a clipped voice. "You will leave the hall first with Mr. Filch."
British voice actor Jim Dale, once again, doing all of the voices and all of the narration, this time from Book 7, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. I gotta believe, ladies, that there are people who, when they read that segment to themselves, or listen, as we just did, to somebody reading it to them, if they're familiar with all 7 books and everything that has happened in those books up to this point in the Harry Potter tales, they probably choke up a little bit.
Yeah, I would say. Because it is, we earlier talked about choices. It's about choices. Here's a community that makes a choice and stands up to protect one of their own, to make a statement against evil. And that is a sort of choke up moment, but
Suzanne,
it's significant.
King, also, it seems to me that anybody who's read these books knows that part of the tale of Harry Potter, for the 11 years before he found out that he was a wizard, or at least from age 1 to age 11, when he was living with his aunt and uncle and just being treated brutally, in every book after that, there is some segment to the book where the population around him has turned against him again, most of his peers thinking that he has done something wrong or something bad. And then you get to this final book, and all of a sudden, 75%, everybody except the Slytherins, who he knew would never like him anyways, 75% of his school stands up to defend him.
It's a remarkable scene of solidarity. Mm-hmm. And you can read it both in a Christian sense, as I was suggesting earlier, that he has returned. This is yet before the actual death and resurrection that occurs a little bit later, I believe.
It does.
But in any case, it is also a political gesture because at this point, Voldemort has and his minions have formed a very large army. They've taken over the bureaucracy, the government bureaucracy of the wizarding world. The Ministry of Magic has been completely infiltrated and controlled by Voldemort. And so it's not only a gesture of solidarity of 3/4 of the residents of Hogwarts school in Harry's camp, but it is also a very brave gesture of defiance against the adult world, which has been taken over by the equivalent of a fascist dictator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's pretty clear that in addition to the religious allegory, J.K. Rowling is also reflecting on the very proud past that Great Britain can celebrate of having turned against several fascist regimes on the continent during the World War II period and really stood up, Little Britain stood up against that threat.
Chair of the Washington and Lee University English Department, Suzanne Keene, is one of our guests. Sitting next to her, James Madison University Professor of Writing, Rhetoric, and Technical Communication, Elizabeth Gumnior. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Phone number 888-WMRA Talk in Harrisonburg. Lindsay, thanks for dialing in. Your question or comment for our guests, please.
Hi, thanks for having me. I was interested to hear the discussion about how it's inspired readers out of students. I am a high school teacher. I actually currently teach online, but when I was in the classroom, I was a holdout on Harry Potter. I did not read for years and years because I thought it was just a trendy kind of piece of fluff throwaway. And some of my students encouraged me to read it. And eventually I gave in and devoured the whole series. I think it was on book 6 when I started, so then I had to wait for book 7. But I was one of the first people to get it, of course, because I was new to it. And then that it just opened the floodgates. From there on, I had students just recommending constantly what to read. I read all the Inheritance series because of it now, and I read Twilight, much to my own chagrin. But I... getting a dialogue between students and teachers about reading is so much better when it comes from the students, when the students are the ones encouraging the teachers to read.
Lindsay, yes. If you could hang on for us. We have another Harrisonburgite who just called in, who I think may have something similar to say. So I want to get you all talking to each other. Anna, thank you for dialing in on Virginia Insight. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I just graduated from JMU, and I grew up reading the Harry Potter books over and over. I read them repeatedly. And yes, like you all have been saying, one of the main things that I found through reading the Harry Potter books is it really did help me see people who are typically different or who are labeled different and accept them. And I mean, it's hard to even like admit this, but there are people in my school that would be like, you know, just classified as like a nerd or a dork or a bookworm. But I would see them reading Harry Potter and we would become friends. And so it really did just like cross those lines. And like the other caller was saying, cross the lines between teacher and student, cross the line between, you know, the cool kids and the nerds. And there are just all these, we could all talk about one book with these characters that we all loved and like treated as our own friends, really.
Anna, did you say where you just graduated from?
I just graduated from James Madison University.
And with a degree in?
Dance.
So in the world of dance and theater, and I imagine you had to take classes that were outside that world as well, Did you get a sense that there were fellow Harry Potter travelers all over who were seeing education differently than they would have if they hadn't been reading Harry Potter stories?
Yes, I do. I think that those of us who read Harry Potter, it's almost like you're part of something kind of exclusive. Like I'm aware of other people that I know that have read it, or I'm also aware of people who've only seen the movies and not read
yes.
the books.
Yeah.
And, and then I would say, yes, it does make people more excited about education. I was just talking to somebody, actually who's in middle school, my neighbor, and she says she hates reading. She hates all books, and the only books she liked were the Harry Potter books. So that didn't really help her to, like, keep reading, like, in school. But at least she read those seven, you know, huge books, and that's, like, a really big thing that she did.
So important, especially at that middle school age. I mean, this is wonderful testimony, both from the experience of a student, a member of Generation Hex, and also from a teacher who has had the wonderful experience of having students press books into her hands. I love that about being a teacher.
Yes.
There's so much that I read because it has been, students have insisted that I read it. And I think that in both cases, the thing that's remarkable about these stories is that these are stories about reading pleasure. These are not stories about assignments. These are not stories about writing a paper, although you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can certainly
mm-hmm.
perform research and do literary analysis, and the richness is there to sustain that kind of work. These are stories about people finding pleasure in the reading experience itself and in the aftermath of the reading experience in conversation with one another about books.
Yes.
Once you get hooked on that feeling, It's a wonderful feeling to meet a new person, as I'm doing today with my my conversationalist across the table here, and think, well, what might she have read that she could tell me about mm-hmm. that I would mm-hmm. go on and read? And that's a habit that is formed mm-hmm. through these connections that are made over
and
books.
And it's the idea of the crossing lines. And we're crossing lines student to teacher, students with students, but also teachers with other teachers and across the disciplines. I can talk to a lawyer or a legal scholar and not understand what he or she is talking about, but we can talk about Harry Potter and all of a sudden that becomes clearer.
Lindsay and Anna, thank you both so much for calling in, and I invite you to stay tuned to this one last clip. I think it's the last one we have time for, but it touches on several of the points that have already been made. This too comes from Book 7, Random House's audio version of the complete texts, and once again, voice actor Jim Dale.
"You won't be killing anyone else tonight," said Harry as they circled and stared into each other's eyes, green into red. "You won't be able to kill any of them ever again. Don't you get it? I was ready to die to stop you from hurting these people. But you did not. I meant to, and that's what did it. I've done what my mother did. They're protected from you. Haven't you noticed how none of the spells you put on them are binding? You can't torture them. You can't touch them.
You don't learn from your mistakes, Riddle, do you?
You dare!
Yes, I dare, said Harry. I know things you don't know, Tom Riddle. I know lots of important things that you don't. Want to hear some before you make another big mistake?
So, Suzanne Keene, what do you think Harry Potter knows that it's important for everybody else to know?
Well, he knows that love and self-sacrifice done out of love for others is the ultimate protection. And that is obviously a Christian message, but it isn't only a Christian message. The virtue of friendship, which the book is full of, and this is a thing that Tom Riddle cannot experience, according to Harry and according to Dumbledore. He never really had a friend.
In case
Tom Riddle is the boy's name who grows up to become Voldemort.
Right.
Voldemort is a self-styled name that Tom Riddle takes on as he attains his power.
I imagine 90% of the people listening know that, but there might have been some
people. But you never know. There might be one person in all of the United States who hasn't heard of that. But in any case, Tom Riddle, Voldemort, cannot have a friend. He has minions. He has people he controls. He has slaves, but he doesn't have friends. And to take it outside of a Christian context and put it back into that ethical context that Elizabeth was talking about earlier, the Aristotelian virtue of friendship, of cultivating friendship, is really one of the key elements of his ethics. And it is something that it's extremely important to remember that when we're talking about these weighty matters of political or ethical or moral choices, that it all begins and ends in your capacity to love one another, to have friends, to act together as friends, to exhibit loyalty, and to do things for other people, including other people who are not necessarily the popular people.
Yes, yes. And I think that that message is so important in our world now, our complicated 21st century. And to have this century start with a generation of young people who understand this message, we must show in some way our capability to care for each other. That is heartening. That is absolutely heartening in a very complicated, very tension-filled and conflict-filled world. And I think that's one of the things, one of those factors that opens our students up now more than ever before to learning, to finding out what is it that we have to do, that we can do, how can we bring this awareness together with action? And all of that opens them up to experiencing education in new ways, in ways that make really a sham, which it already is, out of things like No Child Left Behind. There's more than standardized learning.
Left, so I want to make sure that Elizabeth gets her words in here. This is a different Elizabeth who's posted to us on Facebook. This Elizabeth says, my sister Carolyn gave me my first Harry Potter book. I took my time getting to it until I had a child to share it with. The child took off reading them on her own, and so did I. They're wonderfully written and fun to read, and I am a senior citizen.
Oh, that's a wonderful piece of testimony.
It's generation crossing. It's fascinating. These books and what we can all learn from them and how we can engage because of them in these kinds of conversations across generations, across professions, across scholarly interests, globally. It's wonderful. It's fascinating. And it's a gift that we have been given that we really need to appreciate in just that way, in that sort of grand way, I think.
Here's one more from Sue on Facebook who says, there are also some athletic advantages. My daughter, who just graduated from JMU, was on their Quidditch team. It got her out from behind her computer to get some fresh air and exercise. It's also a fun game to watch. Imagine rugby and dodgeball with a broom between your legs. Elizabeth, I didn't know your school had a Quidditch team.
Yes, we do.
Div 1, I hope. NCAA Division 1 Quidditch.
Yes.
It's hardcore.
It's hardcore.
Our guests have been James Madison University Professor of Writing, Rhetoric, and Technical Communication, Elizabeth Gumnior, plus the chair of Washington and Lee University's English department, as well as that school's broadest professor of English, Suzanne Keene. Thank you so much, both, for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tonks, beside him, looked simply radiant. Happy birthday, Harry, she said, hugging him tightly.
17, eh?
Said Hagrid as he accepted a bucket-sized glass of wine from Fred.
6 years to the day since we met, Harry. Do you remember it?
Vaguely, said Harry, grinning up at him. Didn't you smash down the front door, give Dudley a pig's tail, and tell me I was a wizard?
I forget the details,
Hagrid chortled.
All right, Ron, Hermione.
We're fine, said Hermione. How are you?
Not bad. Been busy. We got some newborn unicorns. I'll show you when you get back.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition of Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.